Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. The bank holiday Saturday front pages are not very festive, I have to tell you. The Irish Times: Britain agreed to return of 201 migrants. So the UK accepted that it would take back over 200 migrants under a 2020 agreement with the state, although none has been sent back. The Irish Daily Mail is going on that ongoing rowing between Ireland and Britain over migrants as well. So their headline is "Bid to send migrants back to UK, quotes, pointless." And that is Michael McDowell warning the legislative quick fix to return asylum seekers would breach EU law. And actually, it's kind of, this is kind of a pincer movement by what you might call the barristers call Michael for, quotes, common sense. So Michael McNamara is in on it too. He's saying it's an entirely academic exercise. So basically, their point is that while the Rwanda policy is in place in the UK, any attempt by us to send people back to the UK, they say, would end up in the EU court in Strasbourg, basically, and won't happen. The Irish Examiner is leading on the protest at the Taoiseach's house the other night. Protest at home unacceptable. Politicians, families and home should be out of bounds, the Taoiseach has said. And the Mirror leading with that too. Harris, leave the kids alone. The Irish Independent: taxpayers to top up the TV licence in RTE funding plan. So basically, households face the prospect of paying for RTE through a taxpayer-funded top-up as well as a reformed TV licence. So this hybrid model seems to be gaining a bit of traction now. Just on what you were hearing there in the news about things kicking off in Trinity, as it happens, Carl O'Brien has an interesting piece on the front of the Weekend Review in the Irish Times today about Trinity and the situation there in terms of protests and connections to Israel. So Trinity has ties with about a dozen Israeli organisations via research collaborations. It also holds investments via its endowment funds in a small number of Israeli companies, some of which are blacklisted by the UN. So they do include companies that have been linked to the supply of equipment, services or materials for use in Gaza or the West Bank. So earlier in the week, Trinity Provost Dr. Linda Doyle, who is obviously like all university bosses trying to walk a line here, she issued a statement saying that the university is going to update its endowment fund investments with reference to the UN blacklist. Now, about cutting academic links, she says it's up to individual academics. She said some colleagues will see value in maintaining a free exchange of ideas. Others will feel deeply uncomfortable having any relationship at all. Fundamentally, it is the right of the individual academic to make this decision. And then one other interesting little quote in it. Patrick Bresnahan, who's a Maynooth University lecturer and member of Academics for Palestine, the piece finishes with him saying, if students protested here, for example, by setting up solidarity camps, okay, which they now have, and the response from the universities was harsh, then I think you would see something similar here to, he's referring to what we're seeing in America, in terms of the radicalisation of students. So we follow that with interest now to see how that all kicks off. OK, we'll move on. Dr. Gabor Maté, good morning.
Well, hello to you.
Gabor, you're an author. You're also a world-renowned expert on trauma, also addiction and, I guess, general wellness and unwellness. And then I think your interview with Prince Harry last year brought you to the attention of an even wider audience. And we'll come back to all that. But will we start with trauma? You'd basically say it's at the root of a lot of our problems, including addiction.
Yes. When you think of addiction, anybody is addicted to any behavior or substance is looking for escape from inner distress, suffering, emotional pain. And so that distress is rooted in life experience. And that life experience is that of some kind of wounding, which is the actual meaning of the word trauma. So yes, all addictions are rooted in trauma, but so are a lot of other health conditions to do with the body or the mind or both. So trauma is not the only, but it's certainly a ubiquitous contributor to people's health challenges all across the board.
Do we all have some trauma?
Well, I've not met too many who have not been traumatized to some degree or another. There's the ranges of trauma, of course. But we're living in a society that, for the large part, denies human needs. And very few people escape some kind of significant wounding.
What's your trauma?
What's my trauma? But first of all, let's understand what trauma is.
Okay.
Trauma is not the things that happen to us. So in Ireland, you can talk about historical trauma, collective transgenerational trauma, which has to do with hundreds of years of foreign occupation, oppression, starvation, killings, the scandals that have been uncovered in recent years and decades of the children being abused in the claws of the church. These are collective huge traumas that affect all of a society, and it's not unrelated. In fact, it's totally related to the fact that, you know, Irish people, not exclusively, but notoriously, tend to drown their sorrows in drink. Well, what is the source of those sorrows that they're trying to drown? It's this collective transgenerational trauma. Then there's trauma in an individual sense, where these things happen to not just to large groups, but individuals. But trauma is not the things that happen to us. Trauma is the wound that we sustain as a result of what happens to us. So in my case, my trauma was induced by my experience as a Jewish infant under Nazi occupation in my first year of life in mid-Europe, in Hungary. That was a traumatic event. The trauma is the shame that I feel about my existence, or the sense that I have to validate my presence on this earth. Those are the wounds that I've had to work through and heal.
And it's interesting, your trauma, I guess, it did screw you up as an adult. You developed, I know, at least two addictions. One was to work. The other was a more unusual addiction, but nonetheless, you would say an addiction and one that was very corrosive to you.
Yeah. So again, if we understand addiction, which incidentally in an indirect way comes from a Latin word for slavery, you're actually a slave, enslaved to something. You have no freedom over it. And in my case, it was compulsive shopping for compact discs. And people think, well, how's that an addiction? But if you define addiction where a person finds temporary relief or pleasure and therefore craves, but then suffers negative consequences as a result of, and does not desist despite the harm, so craving, relief, pleasure, short-term, damage in the long-term, inability to give it up, that's what an addiction is. And so my shopping compulsion made me lie to my wife, spend money that, you know, was not appropriately expended, made me ignore my work and my kids. Point to realize is that addictions go way beyond substances.
Yeah. Are most of us addicts of some kind these days? Like, I mean, I suppose chasing dopamine or chasing some kind of buzz, essentially.
Well, that's the whole point, is that dopamine is an essential brain chemical. Now, you can elevate dopamine levels through substances. So nicotine elevates dopamine levels. That's why people get hooked on tobacco, because dopamine gives you a sense of vitality and aliveness and the motivation, and it can calm the nervous system. Dopamine is elevated by stimulant drugs like nicotine and caffeine and crystal meth, but it's also elevated by thrilling behaviors like gambling or seeking pornography or shopping and so on. So whether you're addicted to a substance or it's a behavior that elevates dopamine levels, you're still chasing a chemical high.
In your most recent book, The Myth of Normal, you have a great sentence. You say the mind makes the world, yes, but the world makes the mind first. So I guess you're saying that our childhood experiences, back to the trauma, gives us a certain view of the world. And explain then how that creates our reality as adults.
Well, let's say that you believe that the world is a horrible place you're on your own. Everybody's against you. People want your house and your wealth and your wife, and these are your friends. So you live in a dog-eat-dog world. If that's what you believe, how are you going to behave? You're going to try and make yourself big and grandiose and as intimidating as possible. You'll be aggressive. You'll be competitive. You'll be grasping, holding on to everything and trying to gain more before let's take it from you. In other words, you become president of the United States because Donald Trump, who said as much in his autobiography. Now, how did he get that view of the world? He developed that view of the world in a home where, according to his psychologist niece, Mary Trump, his father, Fred Trump Jr., was a sociopath who tormented his children. So Donald Trump's worldview was shaped in his family of origin. And then he acts out that view of the world on the rest of the world once he has the wealth and the power to do so. He did not create the world, that created his mind. He was born into it. He had no power over it. All he could do was adapt to it. The human brain is actually shaped by the environment so that rather than being genetically determined, the dopamine circuits in our brain and the hormonal circuits that can modulate love like oxytocin and endorphins and or a mood regulation like serotonin, these circuits are created by the child's interactions with the emotionally caregiving parents. When that environment is disturbed for either political, historical, or personal reasons, that child's mind takes on a certain view of the world and that child's brain is shaped in certain ways. So then we enter the world with this brain that and this mind that was programmed for us by circumstances beyond our control. Now the question is, do we have the grace and can we get the support and do we have the motivation to create a new view of the world and a new view of ourselves, not as programmed by those earliest experiences, but as a matter of conscious choice. And that takes a lot of work. That's actually what's called sobriety. And when I talk about sobriety, I don't just mean abstinence from addictive behaviors. I mean a sober reflection of what's actually going on. It's very hard for people to attain that state of freedom where they're liberated from their childhood programming and trauma.
Okay. We might come back to how we fix ourselves as adults, but you've written a lot about what our children need from us as well and how we might try and prevent, I guess, passing on our trauma onto them. Like, I believe you yourself, you told your kids, look, I'll pay for your therapy because it's my fault you have to go to therapy, yeah?
Yeah, I said to them, I screwed you up, I'll pay for your therapy. And believe me, they've taken me up on it. I was a young parent. I didn't know I was traumatized. I just thought this is life. Unwittingly, unconsciously, and despite all the love and all the devotion that we have, we can just pass it on transgenerationally. It's just a law. There's two ways we can hurt children. One is by doing bad things to them that shouldn't happen. That means violence. That means abuse, verbal assaults, witness a parent being addicted or a parent dying, a parent being jailed, divorced, neglect, a parent being mentally ill. But there's another way we can hurt kids is not by doing bad things that we shouldn't, but by not meeting their needs. To be loved, accepted, cherished, valued for who they are. To be able to play freely, spontaneously out in nature. To have all these emotions validated and supported by an attuned parenting environment.
Is that to suggest then that we...
A lot of parents.
Is that to suggest that we mollycoddle them a bit? Like, does that preclude disciplining small children?
Well, no. It's the source of disciplining young children. If you look at the word discipline, you guys are a Catholic country. You've heard about this fellow called Jesus. Jesus had disciples. They followed him. Did they follow him because he punished and threatened them? Or did they follow him because he loved them and they loved him and they trusted him? And so children who feel safe and seen and understood, they will naturally follow the healthy expectations and guidance of the parents. We're not talking about permissive parenting. There's three kinds of parenting. Permissive parenting, where the kid just does what they want. That's terrible for children. Parenting is not a democracy. It's a hierarchy. We're in charge. You don't get to eat five cookies before dinner. No. Then there's authoritarian parenting, which is usually what people mean by discipline, the employment of punishments and threats to get the child to follow your dictates. That's not quite as bad as permissive parenting, but it's pretty bad when you look at the impacts. Then there's authoritative parenting, where the parental authority doesn't come from threats. It comes from the child's natural desire to belong and to be held and to be guided by the parent. So mother bears don't have to punish their cubs. Cubs just follow the mother bear. They're disciples. They follow. And so there's another book that I helped to write. It's called Hold On To Your Kids, Why Parents Need To Matter More Than Peers. In that healthy relationship, discipline comes naturally.
Okay. You're also interesting in that book on as the kids get a bit older. And I suppose there is a kind of a view these days that we accept that when kids get to be teens, that they become more independent of parents and family and they drift off and their peer group becomes their kind of primary tribe, if you will, and that this is a good thing. They should be growing independence. You think that's a dangerous view of things?
It is. It is true that the human being is not meant to be a cuddly, compliant little ball of pleasure all their lives. They're meant to individuate, become their own persons with their own meanings, their own sense of the world, their own preferences, knowing who they are. That's called individuation. And that individuation process begins at 1.5. Because I don't know about Ireland, but I can tell you in many places in the world, what is the word that the kids start using at age 1.5?
Me?
The word is no. And you know, in our wisdom or lack of it, we call that the terrible twos, you know? That's actually a healthy movement on the part of the child to individuate, to become their own person. That's a lifelong process, and that's nature's agenda. Nature doesn't want you dependent on your parents for the rest of your lives because your parents are going to die. And then what? Adolescence, teenagehood, is another time of individuation. That's healthy. But if you look at traditional cultures, that entering the adult phase was guided by elders, was guided by ritual. It wasn't guided by immature fellow creatures. And what's happening in our society is that because of the absence of parents from their children's lives, more recently, the ubiquity of social media that connects kids to each other, the peer group has taken on a far too important role that's completely unhealthy, and it undermines the natural dynamic of individuation.
Okay. The full title of The Myth of Normal is Trauma, Illness and Healing in a Toxic Culture. So look, these are two big questions now, but maybe you can give me reasonably pithy answers. Why is normal a myth and what's toxic about the culture?
Yeah, well, the two questions are closely correlated. So as a physician, I was trained to understand that human life and human health can thrive within a certain normal range of circumstances. So below a certain range of body temperature, we can't live. And above it, we can't live either, can we? So there's a normal range. Now, unfortunately, we transpose that to society. We assume that whatever is normal is also healthy and natural. So for example, this peer orientation of kids, it's so normal because it's so ubiquitous, we think it's natural and healthy. It's neither natural nor healthy. It's a very new and unhealthy phenomenon in human life. So that's one aspect of the myth of normal. Another aspect is that the case I'm making in, for example, in relationship to addiction, I'm saying that addiction is a normal response to emotional pain. Not a healthy response, but a normal one. People are traumatized. Naturally, they want to escape from the pain. Should we look for the abnormality in the individual or in the circumstances that created the pain they're trying to escape from? As far as the toxicity is concerned, take this world culture in its very, very basic sense. If you're a laboratory scientist growing bacteria in a petri dish, we call that a culture. And if the microorganisms in that culture were thriving, you'd say it's a healthy culture. But if they're falling ill or dying or not reproducing, we'd say it's a toxic culture. So if you look at human culture as a large laboratory dish, what are we seeing as the results? Increasing rates of addiction, increasing rates of mental health conditions, increasing number of children being medicated for this, that, and the other, rising rates of autoimmune disease. This is a toxic culture. In many ways, this is a culture that does not support the health because it doesn't support the needs.
I just thought we could talk about some of the ideas in the book. So, Gabor, we have a kind of a trope or a joke here in Ireland, and I'm sure you have similar in Jewish families, but the notion of the Irish mammy, right? So Irish mammy, she'll always eat the burnt bit of toast because mammy likes burnt toast, right? There's a change a light bulb joke. How many Irish mothers does it take to change a light bulb? None. Yeah. You just all go out and enjoy yourselves and I'll sit here in the dark, right? So there's a grain of truth, obviously, to all jokes. And I suppose women in particular, in general, they can be more so than men, maybe, people pleasers. They can tend to suppress their own needs often. You talk a lot about this in the book and how damaging it is. Being nice, essentially, you think is dangerous.
Well, yes. Depends where the niceness comes from, actually. There's a book written by a palliative care nurse about 12 years ago from Australia called The Top 5 Regrets of Dying People. And in family practice and in my palliative care work, I noticed the same patterns. The top regret is that I didn't have the courage to be myself. I suppressed my true self. What I saw in family practice is that the people that develop chronic illness tended to be extra nice. They suppressed their own needs in order to support the needs of others. They tended to repress healthy anger. They were deathly afraid of disappointing anybody. Now, nobody's born with those.
I know you're not suggesting that that's the whole reason why people get sick, and you know, we don't want to blame people's personalities for them getting sick, but a factor in it.
I'm suggesting that it is a reason why people get sick. And let's separate that from blame. I mean, you're quite right to bring up the issue of blame, but I got nothing to do with blame here. I'm saying that these patterns of self-suppression undermine the immune system. I don't make this stuff up. It turns out that the human emotional system is inseparable from the immune system, from the hormonal apparatus, and from the nervous system. It's all one system, scientifically speaking. And so that when you suppress one aspect of it, you're actually messing with the other. So if you look at healthy anger, what is that? It's a boundary defense. If I were to invade your space, you better get angry with me saying, no, stop it. That's a healthy boundary defense. The immune system is also a boundary defense meant to keep out noxious influences. When you repress emotions, you're also suppressing the immune system. And of course, you're more prone for disease. The question of blame, though, there's no blame here. You know why? Because no infant is born repressing their emotions. Have you ever met a one-day-old baby that suppresses their emotions or tries to be extra nice to please people? Nobody's born like that. These are the traits that we develop in response to trauma, in order to belong, in order to be acceptable, in order to be liked, which is the essential need of the child. The child automatically, unwittingly, and unconsciously represses their emotions for the sake of being accepted. That's what I call the tragic tension between authenticity, being ourselves, and attachment, being accepted, being validated, being held. No child should be put in that position. Can we blame people for being traumatized as 2-year-olds or 3 or 4 or 5-year-olds? So there's no blame here, Brendan. But I am saying that those emotional patterns do undermine physiological health, which is simply science.
And you cite a lot of scientific research in support of all that. I wonder, though, what kind of response do you get from, and you're not remotely dismissive of conventional medicine or anything, but how does the conventional medical scene, mainstream medicine, treat you? Do they regard your theories as a bit simplistic, or do they accept that, you know, you're onto something?
Well, first of all, let's not totally personalize it. I didn't create this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there's been research now for 100 years, published in major medical journals, scientific journals. The problem with medicine is, like any other any ideology, it just screens out what doesn't meet its biases. But I can tell you that I just gave a talk in London maybe 2 months ago now. Hundreds of doctors were there, really appreciating it. saying, yeah, I see it, but nobody's articulated it. I get a lot of those responses from fellow physicians.
Okay. So, right, then to the healing bit, and you called it sobriety earlier. Are you able to tell me here in the context of a radio interview in a few minutes how we go about getting over our trauma and not passing it on?
Yeah. So first of all, let's look at that word healing. It means wholeness. That's the Anglo-Saxon origin. The essence of trauma is a disconnection from self. And I've been talking about that. We get disconnected from our emotions. We even get disconnected from our bodies. And that disconnection is adaptive. When a child is suffering deep emotional pain, or worse, is being physically abused, and they can't get help, and they can't, of course, escape or fight back, one of the adaptations of the human organism is to disconnect so as not to feel the pain. So there's nothing wrong with that disconnection. It's adaptive. The problem is that same disconnection then creates difficulties and suffering later on. So healing means wholeness. It's coming back to our wholeness that we lost in the first place. How do we get there? Well, first by recognizing it. And that, you know, we're pretty stubborn creatures. So for me, it took a fair bit of suffering on my own part and the suffering I was creating for the people that I love before I realized I better do something. I better start looking for the reasons why I'm behaving the way I am. So at some point, there has to be some level of discomfort. And then there needs to be a kind of compassion towards the selves, not self-judgment of what a horrible person I am. Or, you know, I mean, there needs to be remorse for sure, but remorse and okay. shame and guilt are not the same thing. There has to be some sense that something's not working and some curiosity about why not. I thought of this a couple of days ago, that every human being is born with certain needs and expectations of being loved and accepted and being cherished and valued and understood. And this is true for you and for me, for Hitler, for Stalin, for Netanyahu, for anybody. And then how do we end up so completely foreign to what we began life with? Well, a lot of trauma, both institutional, societal, cultural, historical, and individual. So there has to be at some point some curiosity. Does it need to be this way? And if not, what's the way out? And that curiosity is the key. Of course, there's a lot more to healing, but you take a person who's an alcoholic, we can make three assumptions. One is that they're born that way, genetically programmed, which is total nonsense.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of doctors would argue there is a genetic component to it.
And that's because they don't understand genetics. They haven't looked at it. There's no alcoholism gene. Nobody's ever found a gene for alcoholism. So what is passed on generationally is not alcoholism as such, but trauma. And alcoholism is a response to trauma. So something running in a family doesn't make it genetic. Nobody's ever found an addiction gene. There are genes that make people more sensitive and more prone to feel pain and therefore more of a need to escape from pain, but there's no genes that program anybody to be an alcoholic. So we can assume that it's a genetic issue, we can make that assumption, or we can assume that these people are just morally weak, lacking willpower, ethically lacking, deficient human beings. In other words, we can judge them, or we can say, what is the pain they're trying to run away from? And that's the third approach is what I'm recommending. And, mm-hmm. and if you look at anybody that you know who's got a drinking problem, I'll tell you, they suffered in their childhood.
You've mentioned the word shame a few times there. It's a very powerful word. I think it's a particularly powerful word in this country. I think shame is really corrosive to so many Irish people, and we have a lot of shame down the generations. Is that, do you think, from our collective trauma here in Ireland?
I think it is. I know, you know what, I'll just say that at this point, I can't pretend to be an expert on Ireland, yeah. its history, but I do know something about it. So what I'm saying is an interpretation. If it doesn't land for people, I would totally understand. In the first place, I mentioned before this collective trauma that Ireland has undergone, you know, until at least until the last century of foreign occupation and suppression. And one of the impacts of trauma is shame, actually. The traumatized individual tends to believe that there's something wrong with them. Otherwise, these things wouldn't be happening. So that's just a natural outcome of an unhealthy, but natural outcome of trauma. I just recall reading James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a young man. And there's that sermon in it where these kids are taken to church and they listen to this sermon about just how sinful human beings are. Mm-hmm. And how that whole Catholic concept of sin, that there's something wrong with us as human beings just because we're human beings, that's a powerful shame inducer. And how difficult it is, you know, I mean, as a Jew, I can talk about Jewish guilt. You know, there's a joke about, you know, what Jewish Alzheimer's is. You forget everything but the guilt, you know. And the same thing could be said of Catholic guilt. It's just pervasive and corrosive. Of course, from the church's point of view, and again, I'm speaking as a non-Catholic from the outside, tell me to go to hell if it doesn't apply. In fact, I probably will, according to the Catholic faith. But that sense of shame in people is a powerful way of maintaining control, because then the institutionalized religion is the only path out of that shame and that sin. That gives you a lot of...
Okay, we're going to give you a problem, and guess what? We're the only ones with the solution to your problem.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. We're the solution to your problem as long as you obey us. And it doesn't matter how badly we treat you, you still have to obey us. Otherwise, guess where you're going? And then thirdly, and I referred to this earlier, and I know that over the past, I forget exactly when the first revelations about the way the church treated so many children.
It's been coming for decades, but we've listened to, we've probably listened a bit harder in recent times.
Okay. Well, that's another source of shame, because children, you see, are narcissistic. And by that, I don't mean anything negative or pathological. I mean, they take everything personally. So when bad things happen to a child, they believe this must be because I'm a bad person.
And listen, of course, as you alluded to there, as a Jewish man, you know all about intergenerational trauma. You have a kind of a journey here. You would have spent your younger years as a committed Zionist, and now you've become a very strong pro-Palestinian voice.
Even the word pro-Palestinian is a certain way of putting it. If you opposed Nazi anti-Semitism, does that make you pro-Jewish and anti-German? Or does it make you pro-truth and pro-justice? So it's not that I intend to be pro-Palestinian, and it's not that I approve of or support everything that any Palestinian ever does or has done. It's that I'm pro-justice, I'm pro-truth. And the truth is that the Palestinian people have been oppressed, systematically massacred, dispossessed, tortured, tormented, and right now, mass murdered by the Zionist project. To say that is not to be pro-Palestinian or anti-anything. It's just to say that this is the truth as I see it. It's the same impetus that made me a Zionist. Because I thought, here's my people that suffered so much. That's because we were small minorities, weak, vulnerable, unprotected. We need our own state. I thought that was the truth. Until I found out that Jewish dream, beautiful as it was in isolation from reality, in actual practice, was achieved by imposing a nightmare on the indigenous population of Palestine, with the same help of the British Empire that oppressed Ireland, by the way. So it's no surprise to me that of the many countries in the world, Ireland is one of the most vociferous and most principled when it comes to defending Palestinian rights, because you've been through the same oppression at the hands of the same empire that generated the Zionist project in Palestine.
Okay, yeah. And they say that the definition of a sane person is a person who changes their mind when new information becomes available. Gabor, you're coming to the RDS in Dublin on Thursday, June 20th for a one-day immersive event entitled Healing, Connection and Community in 2024 Ireland. There will be meditation, music, workshops and a panel discussion, and tickets and more information are available from JacquelineKyne.com. That's JacquelineKyne.com. Dr. Gabor Maté, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.